Want to make mom's day? Get to your Nordstrom Rack now and score amazing deals for Mother's Day, which is Sunday, May 12th. Find tons of gifts from only $30 at Nordstrom Rack. Fragrance, jewelry, luxury bags, activewear, beauty, and more. Save on Kate Spade New York, Stuart Weitzman, and Ted Baker London. Great brands, great prices. So shop your Nordstrom Rack store today and treat mom to the good stuff from just $30.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
And now, prepare yourself for the only talk radio show you'll want to turn up.
Crank this thing.
Sirius XM Pandora presents the place where your hard rock and metal voice can still be heard.
You bet your ass, baby.
Unfiltered, uncensored, say whatever you want.
Hit the record button. Anything can happen, you know?
I know that ain't nobody out there came to be mellow tonight, now did you? I say there ain't nobody. I say there ain't nobody not out there that even wants to be a little bit mellow. Now is there? Anybody wants to get mellow, you can turn around and get the fuck out of here, all right?
This is the Trunk Nation Podcast with host Eddie Trunk.
Hey, everybody, it's Eddie Trunk, and welcome to another episode of the Eddie Trunk Podcast, new every Thursday. Anywhere you get your podcast, thank you for subscribing and checking it out. As I tell you each and every week, if you're in the U.S. or Canada, be sure to listen to my daily radio show, Trunk Nation. It's heard live Monday through Friday, 3 to 5 p.m. Eastern Time on Faction Talk, Sirius XM Channel 103. And you can also listen to it anytime you want on the Sirius XM app, audio, video, and more. If you are only listening to this podcast and you can listen to Sirius XM radio, you are only getting a tiny, tiny fraction of the interviews, the rock talk, the commentary, and the phone calls that we do on a regular basis on the radio. Think of it as sports talk for rock fans. So come on board with me at Sirius XM. And listen every day to Trunk Nation 3 to 5 Eastern on Faction Talk 103. You also get a sixth show there on Mondays on Hair Nation from 5 to 8 Eastern on Channel 39. So a lot to take in. And again, if you only listen to the podcast, a tiny, tiny taste of what I do 6 days a week live on the radio. So come on board with us for the daily Trunk Nation. Thank you all for checking out the podcast. And be sure to follow on social media at Eddie Trunk. Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook page. Today, we've got two interviews for you that came your way, that we had on the air over the last 2 to 3 weeks, I'd say. First up, we're going to bring you Michael Monroe, the lead singer of Hanoi Rocks, who reunited with his band Hanoi Rocks for his 60th birthday. Michael also has some phenomenal solo records out. He called in from Finland, where, of course, he lives and is based. And at the time of this interview, they were just getting ready to do the reunion with Hanoi for his big 60th birthday. Of course, it has since happened. But it's great to hear Michael talk a little bit about this and, of course, his great records that he's released recently. Really some great solo records. Also this week, Billy Sheehan. We'll bring him to you second. Billy did something interesting. His first ever band, Talus, recently reunited and made a new record of songs that they wrote back in 1985. Not only do we talk about that, but also Billy's history with all the different bands he's played with, including, of course, David Lee Roth and many others. So you don't want to miss Billy Sheehan coming up second. We'll lead with Michael Monroe. Let's get to it right now on the Eddie Trunk Podcast. Joining us now via Zoom from Finland, where it's past 11 o'clock at night, so we appreciate him staying up late. It's been a while since I've seen him. Looking great as always, Michael Monroe. Good to see you, buddy.
Thank you. Great to see you too, Eddie. Thanks for having me.
Anytime. We've been emailing a little bit back and forth about your great new record, and I was saying to you, I was thinking about it. I said, well, I don't know with the time difference. Sometimes people don't like to do interviews in America until they're in America. But then I reached out to you. I said, hey, do you want to do something? And you were willing to do it. And I got to tell you, congrats on another incredible record. I Live Too Fast to Die Young. It's right here. I've been listening to it, loving it. It's phenomenal, man. You've been on an incredible run making music. Tell me about putting this one together.
Thank you. Yeah, well, I wanted to try something different than we went to a different new studio at a place in Helsinki called Inkfish, and the engineer, this guy, he mixed Sammy Alpha's solo album, and I was interested in working with him, and I met up with him, and it was he had a good vision, and it was a conscious risk I took. Went into a new studio, new engineer, and a new environment, and it really paid off. We renewed the band's sound, production-wise, arrangement-wise, song-wise, and sound-wise in the best possible way. So there's a lot of variety. I mean, we had like 34 songs last summer to choose from, and I always try to go for the 10, 11, 12, 13 at the most to keep it short. And this just became a great entirety. We've got 11 tracks all together for the album. It's a perfect amount, and it's the kind of record you want to hear again after you heard it. And it really turned out even better than I expected, I think. Really, as the sound is more, it has more air and more dynamics, and it's somehow more pleasant to listen to. Everything's not on 11 all the time. It's got more depth to it, and a lot of different types of songs that we haven't done before with this band. So it's really refreshing. I'm quite pleased with it, really, really happy with the way this turned out. And it's appropriate. I just turned 60 on June 17th, and it's too late to die young now. I live too fast to die young.
Well, you know, you look amazing for 60 years old. That's incredible. How did you feel about that landmark turning 60? I'm a couple years away from it. I'm starting to shake a little bit just thinking about it, Michael. But how did you do turning 60?
Oh, it ain't nothing. It's great. I feel better than ever. I mean, I had the best birthday. We were touring. The album came out on June 10th, and we went on tour in Europe with, we were opening for Alice Cooper on the 7 shows. And I was the best time I had on my birthday. Actually, we were playing in Germany in a city called Zwickau, and opened for Alice. And then as many other nights, Alice invited me up to sing Schools Out, the second verse of Schools Out with him. And this time he invited me for, he knew it was my birthday. So he invited me up to sing Schools Out, and then he handed me a sword. But, you know, he pops the balloons with the confetti inside, you know, during the Schools Out. So he gave me my own sword. So I could pop the balloons. I always wanted to do that. And then at the end of the song, he introduced the band and everybody. And then he had this guy, Kyler, his assistant, who was dressed up like the Hunchback of Notre Dame, comes up with a birthday cake with candles and lit up. And then Alice sang Happy Birthday to me with the audience, sang Happy Birthday to me. And I was like, whoa, this is the best birthday ever. So that was like, people ask me, what's your highlight, you know, from the 80s or what was the best times? And this is the best time of my life. And that's one of the highlights of my career, I think. When Alice Cooper singing Happy Birthday to me with the audience in Germany, that was really, you know, can't really top that. So I'm happier than
no. No, that'll be a tough one to beat. And, you know, I say this to all the time to my friends. It's like, I don't know, I believe in, and seeing you and the spirit and the energy you have, and having seen you live in recent years and how great the band is and how great you still are, I believe firmly that what we do and our love for this music really does keep us young and keep us youthful. Even if it some creaks when you wake up in the morning, you still have that attitude and that feel about it. And look at a guy like Alice, who's probably 15 years older than you, and how great he still is. It's amazing.
Yeah, he's better than ever. It's a great inspiration. I mean, he told me, he says, Michael, you're only 60. It's nothing. He's 74. He's 74. He says, I'm 74, and I'm feeling better than ever. And he is. And the show is phenomenal. It's better than ever. It's really, everybody should see the Alice Cooper show at least once in their lives. And Alice is amazing. He's a sweetheart. It was really a great pleasure and privilege to do these shows. And he, in the end of it all, he gave me this switchblade. This
wow.
Check it out. With a pearl handle and everything. It's like, and this was the cool. I mean, the switchblade's all right. People say, oh yeah, what's so cool about a switchblade? Yeah, if Alice Cooper gives you a switchblade, then it's cool, man. So this is I get from him. And also I turned him on to some harmonicas. I had, you know, from Japan. This is Suzuki harmonicas that I noticed he plays the harp on a couple of songs. So I gave him a harp from, I had these Suzuki harps, and he said, wow, it sounds great. Much clearer and louder than the one he was using. He was using one of those old Hohner ones. So I was happy to be able to give something back because Alex has, he's given me so much. And 50 years before, I mean, I was, there's a picture of me in 10 years old when I have Alice Cooper record on my lap. And I posted that picture on my birthday. So how could, I could never imagine 50 years before this, when I was 10 years old, an Alice Cooper fan, that Alice would be singing happy birthday to me one day in Germany with the audience. Life is amazing. Life is wonderful. And rock and roll does keep you young. It's yeah. your attitude. It's, you know,
yeah, yeah, for sure. Right? And Alice is a wonderful person too, as you know. I mean, I took my son to see him a few years ago and he had us come back and he actually gave my son a signed harmonica, you know, that he had one and he gave it to him. So I told my son, I said, you don't understand how important this is, but hold on to it. And one day you'll understand what just happened to you. You know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I got these knives too. One of them he signed. These are the ones he uses on stage.
Oh, wow.
Like, he had a dartboard in the backstage. And I was like, what do you play? You throw darts? No, target practice. Because I'll teach you too, you know, how to throw knives.
Yeah.
He's the coolest. Well, and his image is what it is. When you meet him, he's the sweetest, kindest, most kind-hearted person you ever meet, and polite and so cool that I love him to death.
Did he tour? Yeah, no pun there. Did he tour, Michael, when you were a kid growing up in Finland, did Alice Cooper come there and play early on? Did you see the early shows?
No, I never. I wish I had, but he, you know, I loved all the albums. I mean, from Love You to Death was one of the first albums I got as a kid, and I totally loved him from then on. But he was never, they never played in Finland. He did come to do some promotion in 74 when the Muscle of Love album was came out. He came to do a promotion, and apparently he came to taste the Finnish beer because it was back then. He doesn't even remember being in Finland that time. But I was a little kid, and I knew the hotel he was staying at. Me and some kids from my backyard, and we went to hang out outside the hotel, and he was staying at a suite on the top floor, and he threw some posters down, and he was doing interviews and stuff. And then he showed up downstairs. He was taking off. There was a limo outside, and then he all of a sudden he was downstairs with a beer in his hand, with black leather pants and black leather jacket, and looking so cool. And then he came out, and there's a bunch of people are like trying to reach out to him. And all of a sudden, he was next to me. I was like, wow. So I patted him on the back. I said, now I can say I touched Alice Cooper. And he got into the limo, and some girl gave him like a pen and paper. And he just sat there with the pen and paper, and then the limo took off. But I told the story to him later on. I said, so yeah, I touched you then. And I thought, like, wow, I touched Alice Cooper. And cool. Now we're friends, you know. It's amazing.
Yeah, no, and of course Alice has had such a huge influence on so many, yourself included, but you yourself have had a huge influence on a lot of artists and music that came out, starting with the early years of Hanoi Rocks and some of the bands that took so much from what you guys did and ran with it, and whether it was the look or the sound or what have you. What was it for you, Michael, that shaped you beyond Alice Cooper and the early years of Hanoi Rocks to become Michael Monroe? Like, what is Michael Monroe the blueprint of? Like, where did it all come from for you?
Well, there's all kinds of things. I mean, you know, Little Richard, you know, I discovered the Stones and Little Richard and, from Little Richard to the Rolling Stones to the Ramones and blues and funk and reggae. I like all kinds of music. And when I was a kid, there was there were no genres that much. There wasn't even a term heavy metal didn't even exist back then. There was only like records, you know, Led Zeppelin second album was, I got that. My father bought that he probably just went to the record store and asked the clerk what kids are listening to those days. And that was like, Fireball was my first album I owned. Deep Purple, Fireball. Yeah, Deep Purple, yeah. Fireball, and Black Sabbath. I mean, I saw Black Sabbath on TV, believe it or not. That was when I was, you know, I come from a musical family. My grandfather was a cello player. His father was an oboe player. My mother's musical too. She worked at the radio. But I took piano lessons when I was five. My mother made me. And then I saw Black Sabbath live in Paris, 1970 on TV. We had a black and white TV, and I was like a little kid, 8 years old, and I saw that, and I was like, "Whoa, what's this?" And Ozzy Osbourne going nuts, long hair, wild and free and crazy, and I said, "Wow, that is something else." And I really got it. Then I said, "I got their record," and I said, "Mom, can I start taking piano lessons?" Because I realized that music, I could play a Black Sabbath song on the piano, down, 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 you know. And I was learning guitar and stuff, and they had all kinds of music in record shops. So I got into, I'm really open-minded about it. I like all kinds of music, and rock and roll, of course, is my closest to my heart. But took influences from various artists, and Little Richard was the king of rock and roll. I could say now that Little Richard's gone. Isn't Alice Cooper the king of hard rock, rock and roll? Alice Cooper. Pretty much.
Yeah, I never thought about that, but you might be right. I mean, I was talking earlier, and Alice predates Aerosmith, but before you came on the air, I was talking about Aerosmith because they just started up again, and I just had friends that went to their, they did a 50th anniversary show in Boston, and I had friends of mine that were there, and they said Steven Tyler, who is now 75, 76, is, as far as American artists are concerned, maybe the greatest living frontman singer that we still have. I mean, he's ridiculous still, even after all he's been through.
He is definitely one of the ultimate, absolute greatest. He's an incredible singer. He's always, in his pitch is always perfect, and he sings so high. It's incredible. I mean, I've seen him quite a few times, and some years ago I saw them in Vilna, Estonia. They were, I mean, he's hitting the high notes, and it's incredible. He's one of the greatest. I mean, he was also, you know, he also influenced me. And I mean, I had the I must say one great feather in my cap when Les Paul's 75th birthday at the Hard Rock Cafe in New York. I came home one night, and I had a message on my answering machine from Steven Tyler. I'd never met him before, and he had just met my old sound guy, Night Bob, who used to do my sound.
Oh, yeah, I know Night Bob. Sure. Yeah.
So he had ran into Night Bob after, you know, I hadn't seen him after a long time. And he said, what have you been doing? He asked, you know, Night Bob, what have you been doing? And Bob said, you know, I just got back from a tour with Michael Monroe. I says, oh, I love that guy. Give me his phone number. So I got back home, and I was like, there's a message saying, Michael Monroe, Steven Tyler, just wanted to pass on some stuff. I was like, what? And so then Bob calls me. Hey, Michael, I'm sorry. I gave your number to Steven. I hope you don't mind. I said, that's okay. I don't mind. And then I said, well, I wonder what he wanted. Hopefully he'll call back. And then he called me again, and he said, you know, he liked my album, Not Faking It. He said, really liked that record. And then he asked if I wanted to play a saxophone solo on Big 10-inch record on that song at Les Paul's 75th birthday at the Hard Rock Cafe in New York. Because they were going to play it. They played it like a half-hour set with the whole band was like set up there. So I said, yeah, sure. I twist my arm. Of course, I will come and play. And so I did. I even have that on a video because there was MTV was filming then. So they let me have that song, you know, of course, on the condition that I didn't, you know, spread it around, which I haven't. I gave it to Joe Perry, though, when we opened up with the Hollywood Vampires in Helsinki, so about 2017. And I was almost to the date of the anniversary of that event. But yeah, jamming with Aerosmith, playing the sax solo, doing my best over there, and got on stage. Steven was like, where'd you get those lips? Like, you probably bought them in the same store you got yours, man.
And no doubt, you know, you mentioned MTV a second ago, and I'm curious about this because when Hanoi Rocks first broke up, I believe it was around 85 86, right? Initially,
our drummer got killed in a car accident in 84 in December. So we broke up like the spring of 85, finished the band.
And of course, that was tragic when Razzle was lost and you guys made that decision to end at that point. Was that a tough decision to make to end the band at that time? And also, do you think that if you would have continued shortly after that, as so many bands do these days when you see tragedies or band members leaving or whatever, do you think because of what happened with MTV in America, where it became such a big thing? To me, Hanoi Rocks, the sound, the look was so perfectly suited for MTV. Do you think if the band would have hung in there that the story for Hanoi in America might have been different?
Very possibly. I mean, it's hard to say. It could have been, and it's you know, no point saying if this and if that, but it's very likely we were in a position, and the timing was pretty perfect for us to, if the band hadn't broke up, there's a good chance we could have become all the ingredients were there that we could have become one of the biggest bands in the world, of course. But you know, after Razzle died, Sammy Afa left the band. So it was like, we all not only lost Razzle, but then Sammy left, and then there was only me and Andy McCoy on Nasty Suicide. And we weren't really in a great state of mind. I mean, the worst thing that to me was losing my best friend, and Russell was such a great guy, and I was devastated, and we were all devastated. And if we could had a break for half a year or a year or something, and then would have come back to it, we could have kept it together maybe. But the guys that were, you know, the management was trying to, we were, you know, trying to be, we were being rushed into continuing and trying to, you know, keep going. And the drummer and bass player that was supposed to come in, they were not, like, wasn't the same band. And I didn't want the world to get to know Hanoi Rocks as that. I wanted them to, people to know Hanoi as it was, with the integrity and intact, and the band that wasn't just, you know, couldn't be bought, you know. So I wanted to keep it that way. And that's why it was an easy decision. I thought, you know, it wasn't the same anymore. It wasn't the same band. So it was, maybe we could have become one of the biggest bands in the world, but it wouldn't have been the same. It would have been even worse in a way, because I would have been, that's not the Hanoi that Hanoi was, with Razzle and Sammy and the whole band. It was like a family and a street gang, and we were like us against the world. And then it would have been just for the money, and that I thought, you know, it wasn't worth it. It was better to keep at least one band that couldn't be bought, you know.
So yeah, that's what I was going to say. It's such a different world now, because nobody ends, and you see members that have been in bands for 40, 50 years, and they leave or pass away, and the next day the band's still going. It's kind of hard to for me as a fan sometimes to even process that, because but it's just the way the music is. I tell my audience all the time, back in the 70s, back in the 80s, if the bass player didn't show up for a gig, it was like a big deal. If there was a substitute bass player, it was like huge news. Now it's like, well, we just got the guitar tech filling in or whatever, and fans just seem to accept anything thrown at them. They don't even know who's really in the bands anymore. You've got no original member bands. You've got all these things going on. That stuff didn't fly back in the 70s and 80s, really. It was a whole different time.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I mean, to me, it's kind of depends on the band too. I mean, you know, some bands can maybe get away with that, and some bands really I don't see as a fan. I mean, you know, like Dan McCafferty, you were talking about Nazareth earlier, you know, what a singer. I mean, that guy is outstanding, phenomenal, one of a kind. Nobody sings like that. So that's like the sound of Nazareth. To me, and
or a guy like Steven Tyler or Alice Cooper, people like that we talk to. There are key people in certain bands. No doubt.
Aerosmith, not Steven Tyler, right?
Right. Exactly. Yeah, hey, so, you know, I also wanted to ask you, Michael, and want to talk more about the new record here in a second and what's coming up. But one other thing about, well, two quick things on Hanoi. First of all, when you talk about the old days, for people that don't know, you worked with Bob Ezrin on a Hanoi Rocks album on Two Steps from the Move. Yes. What was, I know Bob, I've been lucky enough to have him on this show. He's one of, speaking of Alice, of course, he was so involved in Alice and Kiss and Pink Floyd and so many others. He is known as, and rightfully so, as one of the great producers of all time. He's also known as a guy that's a taskmaster that really pulls and can be tough in the studio. What was, you know, I look at Hanoi Rocks as being such like a loose sort of like in your face, like punky sort of hard rock band. What was it like, Ezrin, trying to wrangle you guys? What was that experience like working with him?
It was a great experience. It was like the best learning experience working with him for all of us. And that's when we became professionals during that process and learned. And he knew exactly how to handle the band, how to handle Andy, and you know, Andy reminding him of Glenn Buxton from the Alice Cooper band. He says that, you know, he's a hard case, but he can work with him. And he was really fantastic. He came to see the band, and then he wanted to meet me first, which Andy was kind of like, why does he want to meet you? I write most of the songs. he had some pointers. He had seen our show, and he said, so Michael, how many times did you get on the PA? I said, I don't know, a couple, two or three. He says, I counted seven. And I said, yeah, so, well, you know, if you do it that many times, it loses the impact. You know, it's just, if you go there once, you go up there, you know, people go, wow. And the second time, maybe, but after that, you lose the
impact. You mean climbing on the PA in live shows?
Yeah, climbing up on the PA on top of it. I do a lot of climbing. So it's, you know, little things about performance and stuff. And he paid attention to the whole package, you know, how, what I do with my hands, people follow your hands. And when you give them time, start clapping and not go so fast and, you know, aimless. And, you know, if you do something like this and then you do something else with your hands, they follow it, the people get confused. And it's just pointers about the performance. And like the way he saw Alice Cooper, man, the first time he saw Alice, he saw him like Alice in Alice's head in a little window going, nobody likes me, it's all my fault. And then, nobody likes me, nobody likes me. Little movements like that. And so, theatrically, it was fantastic. Now to get the music to go with that, then, and they became, that was a perfect match. And I think Ezrin was thinking, he was looking at us like, we're reminding him of the Alice Cooper band. We were looking at working with him the next albums as well. It was a long haul. We were in it for, that's what it would have been if the band would have stayed together. I mean, he was also really, really devastated when the band broke up with the accident and everything. So that was a great experience. I learned a lot, really learned a lot from him and many things. And he was so funny. He did a lot of funny stuff. You know, we were singing the Boiler song. You know, we did the 4-part harmonies, and all of a sudden he rushes into. It was like an animal house. It comes with the fire extinguisher with a bunch of foam, like shh, on all of us, and we're like, everybody else jumped up. Like, whoa! Razzle Kid is just standing there with a beer and like, how you doing, Bobo? All right. He didn't move at all. He was all covered in foam and.
But he literally sprayed you with foam? Ezrin literally sprayed you with fire extinguisher foam?
Fire extinguisher, yeah. He came in, you know, like in Animal House. They do, they wake the guys up and scene. He went, you know, in our pants, like, shh, you know, on the, you know, spraying fire extinguisher on us. And yeah, it's a lot of, he taught me a cool warm-up thing, I remember, when I was, my voice was shot and I'd been singing a lot. And I says, well, you know, I don't feel great. I don't feel like singing today, and my voice is shot and all, and you know, so Bob said, okay, come here, and then he showed me this warm-up thing where I could just relax my throat and find the lowest note, you know, and breathe, show me, you know, how to breathe and just relax and sing at the lowest tone you can get, and it's kind of, it massages your vocal cords, and then he said, sing like that, sing something like that for an hour, we're going out to dinner. I was up to screw you, man. It's just like, so yeah. Then, okay, fine. And I started doing that. And after a while, I was like, wait a minute, I feel better. My voice came back. I was like, he was right. He taught me how to, you know, get my voice back by massaging my vocal cords like that. It was like a thing like that. It's a great warm up before a gig and after a gig to keep you, maintain your voice. And a lot of great pointers for, you know, having to, when you're touring every night, you're singing every night, doing a gig after gig, you know, how to keep your voice, maintain your, because you're, you know, guitarists, they break a string, they can, you know, put a new string on, but your, my body is my instrument. So,
sure.
You gotta take care of that. Yeah. Really great learning experience. And we were, the plan was to work with him, make the next album and the album after that. And, from then on. And so it was really fantastic working with him. I think it was a little bit different, state of mind compared to what he's been later in the later years, you know. He's very strict, I'm sure. I hear that the tape's got to be rolling by 10 a.m.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. He's still at it. Yep, for sure. Hey, so one other thing. Did I hear that you're doing shows? First of all, again, the new album is called I Live Too Fast to Die Young. It's the latest in an incredible string of records that Michael's made with his own band. Sensory Overdrive was incredible. I mean, there's so many great recent records. But I know you've done touring around Europe for this, and I heard, if this is correct, that there's going to be a special show, I guess, in Finland where you're going to play with your band, but also there will be a Hanoi Rocks reunion at that. Is that correct?
Yeah, the original lineup of Hanoi Rocks will the grand finale of my 60th birthday show celebration, the birthday bash, whatever, is going to be on September 23rd now, in a couple of weeks. And there'll be, first of all, Demolition 23. That the Demolition 23 will be the opening band. We'll do five songs or so. And that album, Demolition 23, is coming out now in October. Little Steven is finally releasing it. It's going to be out on vinyl and CD and digital, every format. And it's never been out on vinyl. That's coming out on October 16th now. Remastered, sounding better than ever. So yeah, that band's going to open up. Then it's my solo stuff. There's going to be some guests and some surprises. And at the end of it all, what happened was I had Sammy and Nasty are going to be, you know, the Sammy Alpha and Nasty Suicide are going to be, you know, the Demolition 23 part. They're going to be there anyways. And Sammy's in my band playing the bass. But since they were there, and I met with Chip Casino, the drummer, the original drummer from Hanoi, in Stockholm last December, when we were filming my documentary, which is also in the making. Alex Cooper did a cool interview for that too in Milan.
I look forward to that. I didn't know you had a documentary coming. Love docs. When will that be ready?
That's going to be ready in January. At the end of January, it's going to be coming out. It's going to movie theaters and stuff. Yeah, it's going to be. It's called The Best Kept Secret in Rock and Roll, Michael Monroe. And I met Chip Casino in December. I was what a cool guy he was, and it was nice memories and all. And I invited him over to do something, this other song. But then, and then Andy McCoy, he called me, he invited himself. He said, I heard you got this 60th birthday celebration. If I have time from my world tours, I may have time to show up and maybe I'll come and do Tragedy. Okay, whatever. All right, fine. So then I started thinking about it. I said, wow, that could be actually cool. All the guys would be there, the original lineup. Why don't we do a few Hanoi songs in the end? And then we were going to have it as a surprise. And everybody agreed. And then this is the only way, the only time to do it, you know, like for the right reasons. And then I thought that'd be exciting. And then Sammy Alpha told me one night, she says, you know, are you sure you don't want to let people know ahead of time? Because the fans find out about this later on afterwards, they're going to be pissed off. So I said, you're right. Yeah, we should let people know. So, I mean, it was the ice hall in Helsinki. It was already over half sold out, but after then we had this press conference and had Jeep Casino come over too. All five of us did last Tuesday. And it was fun. And we announced that we're going to be the end of the show will be, you know, the original lineup doing the set of Hanoi songs. And the next day it was all sold out. And everybody wanted to be there.
Yeah, do you think it leads, Michael, do you think it leads to more if the vibe is good and the night goes well? Would you consider doing a tour with Hanoi or do more shows?
No, no, this would be just one time, time.
Special. You worry time, that yeah. just things wouldn't be, you'd worry that the vibe would go bad or?
It's not, I mean, we're going to rehearse for 2 days. So I just, you know, and then. Hopefully, I mean, we haven't seen it. It was surreal to meet this, to be with everybody right there, and like all five of us together after 40 years. You know,
yeah,
it was amazing. It felt really cool, actually. It was fun, and yeah, I think
it starts like this, though, Michael. You know, rock history throughout time is like a one to like the Kiss reunion in '96. Well, that was just to do the acoustic thing, and then there they go. I put Twisted Sister back together, then they went out for 13 years. They said, no, only one charity thing, and that was it. So, you never know, man. You can never say never.
No, I say never say never say never.
how about playing in America with the solo band? I know you tried to get over here a couple times, but COVID got in the way on some stuff, and I know you've been wanting to come over and play. Where are things at for you guys getting to the States? Because your solo band is so killer and the shows are so great. Do you have a plan to try to get over here?
Yeah, well, that's one reason also. And I don't need the Hanoi thing, you know. My current band is the best band I could hope for. I have a great time with these guys, my best friends, and we have a really, like the new album, it's only getting better. And we've been, the States is a bit of a challenge because, like I've said before, it's really a big expense to go on tour there. If you do play just, you know, clubs and, I mean, New York, East Coast, West Coast, always good, but Midwest is such a big area and such a big country that we would have to get on tour, you know, get to open up for a real big stadium act for a year or two, and then maybe somebody would notice. So otherwise it's just, you just lose a bunch of money and, you know, you go nowhere slow that way, you know. So it's a challenge. We were supposed to do the Monsters of Rock cruise, and because of COVID, it was postponed twice now. And next year, hopefully, we'll get to do it. But other gigs right now, it doesn't look like, unfortunately, because I love American audiences. You got like rock and roll is like part of the culture there, and everybody, you appreciate two guitar bands like Aerosmith and Stones and and like Hanoi was, and what we do is like, I know this is the right kind of music for America. So it's quite frustrating. It's just hard to, and especially these days when rock and roll is not the biggest, you know, it's not in fashion, so to speak, with there's all this hip hop and country and whatever is, you know, the biggest thing over there. So, I mean, even rock bands are having to do these tours, you know, tours joining together, three bands or whatever. I mean, we're doing our best to keep good rock and roll alive. And yeah, it's a bit of a challenge, unfortunately. I wish I really would like to play there, but we'll have to see.
Oh, I hope so, because having seen you on the cruise a few times and in other settings, it's always an incredible show, and it's incredible what you at the very young age, still of 60 years old, are still able to do. Man, you get it done every time, and if you get the opportunity to see Michael Monroe and his band, my buddy Steve Conti's been in your band for a while. Of course, he's great as well, and just a killer group. Yeah, go see him. And I hope you can get over. Us as fans, we're selfish. We forget there's a lot of expense when you're coming from another country. It's not cheap, especially right now in America. But I hope that can change and that you can get over here.
Hopefully, yeah. Hopefully there's a way to do it in a good way. And, you know, getting to open up for somebody, you know, one of these, somebody cool and big. And there's a lot of, you know. But I mean,
well, Guns N' Roses doesn't stop. Michael, Guns N' Roses doesn't stop touring. They haven't stopped for 6-7 years. You've got to. They love you. They released the Hanoi Records. Get Axel on the phone. Tell him to take Michael Monroe out as the special guest for GNR on the next run.
That would be great. I would be there in a second if you know. Tell him that we opened up for them actually in London this summer. We played in London. At the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium, actually the first show we were supposed to do two shows, and first show was we were supposed to start playing at 4:30. From 4:30 to 5 was our slot, and then they didn't open the doors. Doors were supposed to open at 3 and or 3:30 at the latest, and there was a delay. I'm still not sure why, but apparently like Axel had a problems with his voice, or somewhere it said he had an anxiety attack or something. That they didn't open the doors for 2 hours. People were outside with no toilets and no water and stuff, and they were kind of pissed. We were waiting on. We were ready to go, like 4:30, ready to play. And then there was only these security people in an empty stadium. And they said, "Well, we're not going to let you play to an empty stadium." I said, "Okay, we'll wait." And then about 5 to 5, we were told that, "Okay, you're not going to play. Your slot's." Went past it. They couldn't open the doors because they didn't. I guess they didn't know whether Guns N' Roses were going to play, and if they had let people in, and if then it turned out that they wouldn't play, they were afraid it could be a riot or something like that. So, but 5:15, the doors opened, and then the other opening act, Gary Clark Jr. They got to play their set. So, I was like, okay, the greatest show we ever almost did.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that. That's terrible. And I've heard of that happening. I've gotten calls to this show recently from fans who were frustrated because they wanted to go see a band that was third on the bill and they can't get in. As you said, the doors aren't open, so they really wanted to see the band, but they physically couldn't get in the venue because of whatever delays. So that actually happened to you. That's terrible.
We missed our slot, so we didn't play the first night. But the second night, we did. Everything went well. They opened the doors on time, and we did play. And we rocked harder than to make up for the night before. This was a great show, but you know, it was like 4:30 to 5 in the afternoon. There was a bunch of people there. People liked it, you know, and it was a perfect combination because I think it worked good with those guys. It would be great to tour with Guns N' Roses. I would love to go on tour with them for a world tour for a year or two. And I'm there, man. If they just, but it's up to them, you know, and they know where to find me. It was second night was great. And the first night they were a little late, but there was, I thought it was really good. People said, you know, Axel had problems with his voice. I thought it sounded great. I thought it was fantastic. And second night, he said maybe himself, because the night after, the second night when we played, the next day they were supposed to play Glasgow, and that show was canceled because of voice problems. So I think then he probably had some problems with his voice.
Right.
But, I thought they were great. You know, they're really, really cool and really good. I'm glad they're out there and, you know, rock and roll these days. It's like,
yeah, we need all those bands filling those stadiums for sure. Yeah. Well, listen, buddy, I got to,
you know, yeah.
Yeah. I got to run, man. It's great to see you. It's great to talk to you. And again, congrats on the latest album. Again, it's out now. It's killer. It's called I Live Too Fast to Die Young. If you love straight up kick-ass hard rock, you will not be disappointed. And honestly, Michael, I've been saying it for a while. This is just the latest in a string of great records. Your last two, three, four records have been incredible. So keep up the great work, and it's great to talk to you.
Thank you so much, and thanks for having me. It's great talking to you, too. Anytime, let me know. I'll be on your show anytime you want. This is a great
pleasure.
Yes.
I hope to be at one of your shows, seeing you do what you do, hopefully soon. So hopefully you can get over here and rock. I look forward to seeing you, man.
Absolutely. Thanks so much. God bless you.
Thank you to Michael Monroe. Check out his latest album. It's really killer. His latest solo albums are really, really good. And as I mentioned, he talks about that Hanoi reunion that has since happened and seems to have gone off quite well, although he has now said, like he said in the interview, he has no plans to continue working with those guys. But we'll see. Things can always change.
Want to make mom's day? Get to your Nordstrom Rack now and score amazing deals for Mother's Day, which is Sunday, May 12th. Find tons of gifts from only $30 at Nordstrom Rack. Fragrance, jewelry, luxury bags, activewear, beauty, and more. Save on Kate Spade New York, Stuart Weitzman, and Ted Baker London. Great brands, great prices. So shop your Nordstrom Rack store today and treat mom to the good stuff from just $30.
Start clean with Clorox, because Clorox delivers a powerful clean every time. Because messes happen. Because...
Hey, listen. Remember how you told me to toss those takeout containers before we left for vacation? And you were like, I'm serious. If that leaks over the counter, it'll be a slimy abomination by the time I get back. And I was like, yeah. Of course. Don't worry about it. I won't forget. Well.
Ooh, yeah. That happens. So start clean with Clorox. Use Clorox products as directed. Rinse after use if in contact with food surface.
Life is a highway. And on it, there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Got another interview for you this week on the podcast. It's bassist extraordinaire Billy Sheehan talking about all sorts of stuff, including reuniting his original band, Talus. Let's get to Billy right now. Billy, how are you, man?
Eddie? I'm good.
Good to talk to you.
I haven't seen you for so long.
It's been a bit. It's been a minute. Yeah, how's things going, man?
Super great. Super great.
How are you enjoying Tennessee? You relocated after decades in L.A. to the Nashville area. How's that been for you?
We love it. It's the weather is great. Winters are mild. People are really friendly. We got a great place and a great spot with raccoons and chipmunks and deer and all kinds of wildlife. And there's no state tax. So that helps too.
Yeah, no doubt. That's always a nice thing. That's, I think, part of the reason why so much of Los Angeles and the musician community has moved to either Nashville or where I am in Vegas now part-time, or Texas or other areas. It's nice to get a little break from that stuff.
Yeah, it gets expensive, that's for sure. I contributed to the state of California for 32 years. You're welcome. And now we move on.
Well, you know, it's interesting what you have that you're here predominantly to talk about today, because it's really a return to your roots, and that is your first band, and certainly the first time I heard of you as a musician and a player, with a band called Talus that was very popular in upstate New York. And you recently put out a new, with quotes around it, album from Talus called 1985. So, I, you know, Billy, this being a national show, I know Talus was
tremendously popular in upstate New York. But for the national audience, give everybody the overview of Talus and its history, if you don't mind.
Well, great. Yeah, we started actually in the early 70s, 71, 72. We're playing in bars, being a copy band. Eventually, we snuck a few originals in there. There's been about 8 incarnations of the band as far as different members coming and going and what have you. Then in 79, actually, we put out an album of originals, or mostly originals. And then by 1980 came along, and by some freak set of circumstances, we ended up opening for Van Halen. And we went around to a lot of America, West Coast and the South and everywhere. So we got the name around a little bit then. Then that version of Talus changed again, and we got the version that is on this newer record. And one of the first calls we got is that lineup was from the William Morris Agency to put us on tour with Yngwie. So summer of 85, we went out on tour with Yngwie, and we had a riot. I think it was Yngwie's first national tour, certainly his first solo tour. And we had a blast. Unfortunately, that tour, at the very beginning of it, we started in L.A., and I had a meeting with Dave Roth, and he invited me to come join him and start a band. So that was 1985, how it kind of ended. So the album is kind of a symbol of everything that led up to that. What an amazing time we had in 1985. And what might have happened if we would have continued on and recorded the songs that are on this new record as we would have back that in that day. So here we are now. And I texted you last night, as you know, having Talus finally actually be on the Billboard charts. Who'd have thunk it? We never imagined we would ever get there. But 30, 40 years later, better late than never.
Yeah, well, congratulations. I mean, that's a really cool thing to see. Now, there's a lot there in what you said. I want to go back to what you said in 1980, Talus being, I believe, an unsigned band for the most part at that time. How do you end up being on a national tour opening for Van Halen, who around 1980 probably would have been 3 records in, Women and Children around that point? How do you land something like that without having a hit or a record deal or a national profile?
Great question. we had a local manager in Buffalo, did our day-to-day stuff. And then the local promoters in Buffalo were big in the music biz. They brought in all the big acts, Van Halen or The Who or Emerson, Lincoln, Palmer or whatever, into Buffalo, into Rich Stadium or other giant venues. So by default, because we were kind of the biggest band around town, they became our managers, so to speak. So they actually sent a cassette of ours down to Premier Talent Booking Agency, who they dealt with so much because of the big bands they booked. And unknown to us, Barbara sent it to Van Halen. They liked it and said, okay, put them on. Now, the interesting side note of that is that was the manager that did that. That was Harvey Weinstein.
Oh, wow. Harvey Weinstein managed Talus?
Yes.
Wow. Man, there's some interesting history there, huh? I mean, wow. So what was it like for you and Talus to be on tour with Van Halen in 1980?
A dream come true. We all love that band to start with. I mean, we were head over heels about them from the very first time we heard them. And getting that tour. And I remember the first night on tour, we were in our dressing room. It was kind of an L-shaped room where I could see the door and no one else in the room could. And I was sitting there, the door opened up, and we didn't know any of the guys in the band. We knew them as fans, of course. In walks Ed Van Halen, and the first thing he says is, which one of you guys is Billy Sheehan? And I said, me, that's me. And I don't know how he knew of me. It might have been from Denny Carmassi, because I had worked with Denny briefly when we did the pre-production on Michael Schenker's first record in London. I went over there for that because we had opened for UFO at one point, and they'd see me play, and Michael called me for that. So it might be where he knew it from. But they were great to us on that tour. They were so nice. They let us do encores, and we became friends. So every time they came on tour after that, we knew the crew guys, so I could always go and say hi, and they'd get me back to say hello to the band. And an amazing turn of events that I'm forever grateful for.
Now, you mentioned 1985, Talis opening for Yngwie Malmsteen, and I was at that show that you played at the Beacon Theater in New York. Did I hear it right that David Lee Roth was actually at that show, and that's kind of like where he approached you about joining his band?
Yeah, he was at the show, but we had already established that at the LA show at the Palladium. I had a meeting with him the day before that show. I had a day off when we came into LA, and so the whole tour, the tough part about it was I love these guys in Dallas so much. We had a wonderful time together, but the whole tour, I couldn't say anything. I was kind of sworn to secrecy. So the whole time that we're doing these shows with Yngwie having a ride in the back of my mind, I'm going, man, we're going to have a little meeting at the end of this tour where I explain what's going on. It was bittersweet for sure. I mean, you'd love to make it in your own band with your own thing and your own songs, but we're still, you know, as you know, getting a record deal, because we did get a record deal right at the end there with Danny Goldberg, who had Gold Mountain Records. He ended up, I think he was Nirvana's manager also later on. Mm-hmm. So we had that. But as you know, having a record deal is no guarantee anything is going to happen. You know, we didn't know if we'd record a record and nothing would happen. And I was just getting kind of antsy for some degree of success in my life. And when Dave came along, I said, I'll take it.
So the record that has just come out, 1985 from Talis, talk a little bit about making this record, the idea to, you clearly had some, felt like you had some unfinished business with the guys. I don't know how long it had been since you played with them until, I don't know if you still, if you have recently or not, but what's interesting about what you've done with this record is when you came together to make a new Talis record, you didn't go in and say, let's write all new songs. You actually archived material you wrote back in 1985 that never came out, right?
Exactly. Yeah, we had two choices. We could take that material that we played live a million times back in the day and like jazz it up and spice it up and modernize it and bring it up to date. Or we could get in the time machine, go back to 1985 and do it like we did it then. So we chose the latter. And I'm glad we did. It was kind of in our DNA a little bit, having played it live so much. But we got together initially, I think 2019. I had done a reunion with the earlier version of Talis, but those guys were kind of unavailable or not into it anymore. So Phil Narrow, the singer, and Mark Miller approached me to maybe we should do a reunion with us. And I said, yeah, okay. So we did a Barnard, New York, right outside of Rochester, had a charity show. So we played for free and thousands of people showed up. We had a riot. And then the next obvious step was, hey, let's do some more shows. So we played the Iridium down in New York. We did shows in Rochester, Albany, Buffalo, a couple other ones. And then we thought, of course, the next step, let's record it. And so we got together in drummer Mark Miller's house that he built, on the drum kit that he built, all together in a room, just like the old days, and laid down the tracks. We did the vocals with Phil in Toronto, me in Nashville, with some special audio software. I was able to do the vocal production remotely with Zoom or FaceTime as our talk back. And we got it done. And there you have it.
Well, it's really like, I'm so glad that you didn't try to modernize it and you went with what 85 sounded like, because to me, it still sounds very fresh. It still sounds very current. It still sounds very live, and it's just great straight up hard rock and really some great songs here. I was listening to the record earlier. So there is some tragedy associated with this though, because your singer, who sings fantastically on the record, Phil Narrow, when you began working with him on recording this, I guess a year or two ago, you had learned that he was sick, correct?
Yeah, we knew he had had a problem, but it had gone into remission. And we didn't know pretty much until the end that things were looking difficult. The end of the recording process. Matter of fact, Phil was going up to that mic, and I saw him on my little video screen in Toronto with our Toronto engineer, Russ McKay, and singing his heart out and just killing it. But I did notice that it was a little bit scatterbrained. like he'd sing a wrong lyric and I'd say, no, Phil, this is what it is. Okay, sing it wrong again. I'd say, Phil, cross out whatever you have there and write in the right lyric. And eventually he'd get it. But it struck me as a little funny and unknown to us. Unfortunately, his cancer had come out of remission and it was not looking good. So as much as I have nothing but the most amazing respect and admiration for Phil Nero, it is even more so now knowing that he walked up to that mic, knowing he was in big trouble, and he delivered as the best I've heard him sing. He just nailed it. And it says so much about the character of this gentleman and his talent and his just relentless push forward in spite of the situation. Pretty amazing.
Yeah, it really is. And sadly, before the record was released, he passed away. So he's not with you anymore to be able to experience the great reaction and reception to this record. But what a phenomenal final statement from him in terms of his performance and the quality of the record and the quality of the performance. And I know that on the record, you actually did a track that's a bass solo that's a tribute to him, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. On Sink Your Teeth Into That album, I had NV43245, which is upside down. It looks like Sheehan. Then on the live album, I did something like that too. So on this one, if you turn down the numbers and letters, if you turn them upside down, you'll see that it says For Phil. And I just wanted to give a farewell to really just a wonderful guy. I mean, we've all heard of lead singer's disease, but Phil Nero was the one guy that had not a trace of it. He's the sweetest, easiest going, affable, friendly, wonderful. Fans loved him, and what a great performer. A terrible loss, and we're glad now that people are taking to this record in such a positive way, because when we first had the record named and the idea of it in 1985 was a tribute to the spirit of that time, and I was in Sunset Boulevard. People were six deep. It was like a Mardi Gras every night, rock bands and players and clubs. And back on the East Coast too, New York, New Jersey, it was jumping all the time. So that was our original thought, what that record was going to commemorate. And then, of course, the turn of circumstances, we're looking at it now more as a tribute to a wonderful man and a supreme talent.
Billy, you mentioned there were a lot of different versions of Talis. The fact that this record has done well and the response has been good to it so far, but obviously against the backdrop of the tragedy of Phil passing away, does that prevent you from potentially doing more with Talis, or is there another move here with maybe a different variation on the lineup or another singer that could come in and pick up the ball and run with it from here, or do you even have a desire to do that?
Well, I do have a desire, but it has to be tempered with some sensitivity here. We would like to initially maybe just do a night in tribute to Phil and see how we feel. We know a singer or two that could come up. Phil's son is also, he sang on the record. His son James, he sang the harmonies on Crystal Clear and a few others, and on Black and Blue, the only new song on the record. So we'd maybe, if he'd be into doing it, we'd invite him up for a couple songs to sing. So we're not sure. I'd love to play more. Playing with Mark Miller is a dream. He's just an amazing drummer. And the guitarist who used Keery. We also did have Mitch Perry on the record for the two songs he contributed to Crystal Clear and On the Take. He did a great job. It was wonderful to have him involved again. But we'll see. The door is open, but we do want to keep in mind that it is a sensitive situation, and I'm not into exploiting anything during situations like this. Unfortunately, we had a similar situation in Mr. Big, the loss of Pat Torpey. We did go out and finish our commitments with Matt Starr on drums, who did an amazing job and is a dear friend, but it's not the same, you know, without the guy. And so since then, we have done nothing. We may do something in the future at some point or other. I'd love to see Paul and Eric again. We'll see. But it's a similar situation. It's kind of tough to get back up there, missing one of the guys, you know.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, what the status of Mr. Big was. Obviously, we know you did initially when you went out and toured, when Pat was still alive. Actually, Pat and Matt were out there for a bit. And then I know that Matt was doing the bulk of the drumming, and I just wasn't sure where it was left with Mr. Big. Eric actually is out now opening for Michael Schenker, doing his own thing. So I know he's out there and been quite active as far as playing and stuff, but there's some, you think there's some opportunity to do, or some interest to do something with Mr. Big again at some point?
I believe so. Yeah, I would love to. I mean, and I get email every day from fans that are just dying to see us play again. And that's very touching. And of course we won't do it unless there's certainly a very big point of attention put on the life and legacy of Pat. You know, that's important to us as well, that because there was four of us and he was one for the whole adventure we had. So, of course, it's going to be in tribute to him for sure. We'll make sure to acknowledge him in every way we can if we do something, that's for sure.
And just hitting you on a few other things from your career, you know, I had Steve Vai on with me a week or so ago, and we were talking about all kinds of stuff, and we got on to talking about David Lee Roth, as we often do, and I was asking Steve, you know, it seems like Dave has this desire in and out to kind of do rock music again. And now he's put out some re-records of Van Halen songs. And seems like there's times where he's going to pop back out there and kind of do rock again, and then kind of goes underground. I was talking to Steve a little bit about this. What's your take on it? And have you had any dialogue with him? Has there been any conversation? Because the world would love to see that Eat 'Em and Smile band again. And I know a number of years ago, you got super close to doing a couple songs in LA at that jam, and it was shut down because of the capacity and all of that. But do you have any dialogue with Dave at all?
No, I haven't. That's a great thing about that thing we did in LA. We couldn't play the show because the fire department shut us down. Rightfully so. It was dangerous. They had too many people in there, but we hung in the back, myself, Dave, Steve, Greg, and our keyboard player, Brett. And I posted a couple photos of that. We're just standing in a circle talking about the old days. And that was almost worth it right there, just to sit there and hang. Because when we were in that band, we'd sit in Dave's basement and tell stories. And we had a riot. It was a great hang, a really great hang. I haven't been in touch with them lately, no. I know I'm in touch with Greg and Steve a lot. Sadly, our keyboard player, Brett, passed away not too long ago, too. So everybody stay healthy, please, man. It's tough out there.
Yeah.
But, but I would love to do it, of course, just for the sake of doing it. Even if it was one show, it'd be a blast. So whatever, if Dave gives a call, if it ever happens, I will likely drop whatever I'm doing and be happy to do it, because he's still my hero, and I still have nothing but the highest regard for him.
And I wanted to ask you about Sons of Apollo, because I know they toured recently outside of the U.S. without you. Are you still doing that band, or have you stepped away from that?
The band isn't doing much now, but when it does anything again, I'm happy to be there. I love the band. I enjoy playing with Mike, Jeff, Derek, and Bumblefoot. It's a blast. All the touring we did was just great, and we made some great inroads elsewhere, so I'm happy to. I know Mike's busy. Is he touring with John Petrucci?
Yep, he's going out with Petrucci. They start on Wednesday, actually. They were both on with me yesterday, actually.
Oh, great. Nice to see that, because I know going back to your old friends, like that's why our phone call is happening here, going back to people you play with in the past, has always been a joy, especially you let enough time go by, because bands are like a marriage, and it's going to have little blow-offs, but you let enough time go by, everything's cool, and it's great to go back with your old friends again.
So can you comment on why you didn't play with Sons of Apollo, or is it just was a scheduling thing, or just something that didn't work for you at the time, or?
No, it was a vaccine thing.
And, oh, okay.
I didn't have proof, and I needed a there was a situation in my family with a particular affliction, and I'd rather not get into that if you don't mind, but
sure.
I was advised to avoid this particular procedure. So I did. It's a tough decision, and I wish I could have been there with them. But, you know, it's a wild world for sure out there now.
Well, Billy, I give you a lot of credit for being honest about that because although I am vaccinated, I completely believe that it should be everybody's prerogative on where they land on that, and everybody should make their own decisions. And there's so many artists right now that have lineups of bands that don't have certain members in them. And for whatever reason, they're not honest about that being the reason that the person that's not with them is not vaxxed or couldn't get vaxxed. I never understood why that's such a thing where people kind of like skate around it. But I appreciate your transparency about it because I respect it. You know, everybody should make their own choices.
Yeah, I agree. Thank you. I posted when it went down. I posted some photos of me getting vaccinated in Germany before we went to India with Mr. Big, who's required to have a cholera, yellow fever, and something else. I'm not against vaccinations, but this particular one triggers a particular syndrome that does run in my family, and I was advised against it. And I played by the rules. I stayed indoors. I stayed away. I wore the mask all the time. I played by the rules as best I could, stayed away from people, and do my best to ensure the health of the people around me. But that's the way it goes, and I respect everyone's decision to do what they do. And I think now, as time is going on, we're seeing that some of the protocols that were enforced strongly weren't absolutely necessary. Mm-hmm. So I think people are lightening up on it, and I'm glad to see that. And I'm glad to see we're mostly over it for the sake of everyone's health and for the sake of everyone's mental health, too, because it's been tough.
Yeah. What kind of things did you do during the lockdown? You actually were doing online instructional courses or actually offering your services to play on records and things like that?
Yeah. Out of nowhere, people would just write to me and say, hey, can you play bass on so-and-so? I learned early on, though, I got to hear it first because sometimes I'd agree to play on something and I'd hear it and I go,
got to do
some fixing here.
Right.
But so I learned early on, but it was cool. So I ended up doing over 600 tracks, about four or five albums and people all over the world in every style you could imagine, from electronic dance music to death metal to straight up rock to country to fusion to classical and jazz. And it was actually good for me because I had to sit there and figure things out. Me and my engineer in Nashville figure how are we going to approach this piece and dig deep. And it was really helpful to me in my playing just to increase my vocabulary on what I do on the instrument by playing all these different things. And also songs that just aren't completely together and the timing's a little off. The drummer blew apart, and we got to figure a way to play through that to make it sound right. And it was quite an adventure itself.
Yeah, that's really very cool. And I'm sure that you made some up and coming musicians very, very happy getting a bass track on their record from Billy Sheehan.
There was this one band from Germany, I believe. I think they're called Stinger, and the guy sounds so much like early Bon Scott. It's amazing. And the tracks were very AC/DC, though not fully AC/DC. And I think their song won like some song contest in Germany or something. So they got some good results out of it. So I'm pleased with that.
And of course, final in the whole Billy Sheehan world is speaking of Portnoy. And I saw Richie a few weeks ago. He was at the tail end of wrapping up his solo tour. We finally have a third Winery Dogs record in the can, done, mixed, mastered, ready to go. And Mike was saying yesterday that the three of you guys have really carved out a lot of next year to dedicate to that fantastic trio you have. So I'm sure you're looking forward to that.
I sure am, man. We're so pleased with the record. We're over the moon about it. And the fact that we're just going to play tons of shows. I love playing with the Winery Dogs. It's three-piece. Makes things very simple and easy to watch each other. I watch Richie. I watch Mike. Mike and I got great bass and drum ESP where we think the same thing at the same time by some odd set of circumstances. And it's a blast to play in that band. And so they're booking it like crazy now. I know they've got a couple months booked already, and now they're looking at other territories. And so we're all very excited. And we have you to thank, of course, for being one of the seeds planted that created the band. by suggesting Richie to Mike and I. So we never forget that, Eddie.
Well, I appreciate you guys saying that. It really means a lot. And I'm just happy that it's gone so well and that there's another wave of it coming. And I have been lucky enough to hear some of the record. And I don't think any fans of the band are going to be in any way disappointed. I mean, you really very much picked up right where you left off. To me, it feels like a lot of elements of what's on the first record, but also some of the more experimental things from Time in the second record creep in a little bit. But the little bit I've heard of it sounds like it's a little more in line with the first record, and it's just killer to me. It's just, I think fans are going to love it, and the material is just stellar.
Oh, I'm so glad. I always say that my three records, Eat 'em and Smile, Mr. Big, Lean Into It, and the first Winery Dogs record. I love that record so much. And again, it's a joy to play with those guys, and we're excited to get out.
And the last thing I wanted to ask you, you know, and I think we've talked about this before, but when you go back to Talas and the early years, and of course, for people that are big Billy Sheehan fans, they know that's where you started. That's where the song Shy Boy, that of course was on Eat 'em and Smile, came from. It's actually a Talas song. I had Sink Your Teeth Into That. I mean, I had those records growing up as a, you know, and again, I saw you back then. And you were so much of a focal point of that band because of the way you played bass and because of your onstage performances and all of that. When you left the band and you notified them that you were going to Roth, I imagine that was a tough thing to do. And I'm wondering what the temperature of the band was like, because it felt like, to me as a fan, at that time, Talas was very much poised to maybe take the next step and really make a big national run. Was that a difficult thing for you, circling back to Talas?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was, it was, like I said before, it was bittersweet that I, you know, chose to leave. But at the time, there was a lot of pressure, too. I mean, we were slugging it out every single night, getting into a van and driving 2 hours, you know, after a 2-hour show, getting in the next day, staying in a Motel 6, maybe get a McDonald's, a Big Mac, if you're lucky. And then the drinking laws changed where it went from 18 to 21. So the bar business got cut in half. So a lot of bars and clubs shut down. So a lot of gigs got lost. And I was just worried about my future. And it was a bittersweet thing to have to make that decision. And I always said, well, the only band I'd ever leave Dallas for was Van Halen and Dave Lee Roth, close enough.
Exactly.
And I was gone. So, but it was tough. It was tough because, like I said earlier, it's you know, your own thing with your own friends from your own town and your own songs, and you'd like it that to be the thing that takes you where you want to go. But sometimes it just isn't in the cards. And I think I made the right decision. But I'm so lucky now I can go back and revisit the friendship, first of all, and also the music that we had together.
And the last thing from me, and I'll let you go, is you mentioned earlier that Talas actually started in the early 70s. And yeah, they came on my radar being a kid from New Jersey, like early 80s. But you as a bass player, early on in your career, were you still, as people perceive you to be now, the Billy Sheehan, the way you play? I mean, were you that accomplished early on? Were you attacking the bass like you do? Were you that animated on stage in your performances? Were you like that from day one in the earliest years of Talas? Or did your style and approach to performing and playing bass evolve through the 70s to what people finally saw with the Eat 'em and Smile band? Had it been building, or were you like that out of the gate in your earliest years with Talas?
Well, it started early. We went to see Mata Hoople, New York Dolls, and Aerosmith. I think it was 73 in Buffalo. And Overend Watts wore these high boots. And I saw him, and I got to get a pair. Overend Watts, the bass player for Mata Hoople. I know you know that. So they had shops in Toronto. So we ended up getting this 6-inch heel, 4-inch platform, giant boots way before Kiss. Kiss started in what year? 76?
74. 73.
74. Oh, really? 73. So they didn't do the boots and stuff, or they weren't known until, I don't know, when the first record. Anyway.
The first record came out early 74.
Oh, really? So I know I was ahead of them. So it must have been, I must have been 73. No matter. The only reason I say that is anytime I post a picture, I would say, oh, look, you're trying to be like Kiss. I go, no, it was, they weren't there yet. So, but so it was a pretty wild look we had. I couldn't move around much in the 6-inch heels, but we still managed to make quite a scene on the stage. And it was during the glam years, like I said, Mötley Hoople, Lou Reed, David Bowie, all that stuff. So it started there a little bit and then went on from there. And it just became kind of a natural thing. I love to play. Hendrix was my first concert, and I saw him, and I wanted to be like him, not as a guitar player, of course, but just as a performer. And that stuck with me as being my very first concert. I saw him in 68. And so my goal was to, and I remember when Mike Varney had a little spotlight, a new talent in Guitar Player magazine, my first little blurb in a national magazine. My quote was, I'd like to be able to do a bass solo for 30 minutes, but not bore anybody. That was the key point. So I don't know if I've achieved that at all, but I'm still firing at it.
I certainly do think you've achieved it. No question about that. Well, listen, man, it's great to catch up with you as always. I'm glad we had a chance to do so. And congratulations on being on the charts with your, you know, really some unfinished business here that you put a nice button on. My condolences about Phil. I mean, that's obviously the bittersweet aspect of this, but it's really nice. What a nice, if this is the closing statement on Talas, what a nice closing statement it is. And above and beyond anything, it really is a killer record. There's some great songs and performances on there. So congrats on that. Everybody check out the new Talas record. It's called 1985 and it is out now, and I highly recommend it. Really good stuff.
Thanks, man. Thank you, Eddie, so much for this interview and everything you do. We really appreciate it. You're the greatest, man.
I appreciate that. Thank you so much, Billy. I look forward to seeing you soon. Winery Dogs Action will be here before you know it. You know you'll be seeing my mug out there as much as possible, and looking forward to that as well. So,
me too. Thanks so much.
Yeah, you enjoy, and I'll hopefully talk to you soon, and stay in touch if you need anything.
Great. Likewise. Thanks, Eddie.
Well, thanks to Billy Sheehan. That Talas record is really good. No joke. I mean, you'd think a band that put a record together like that after so long wouldn't be all that great. It's really, really good. Be sure to check it out. It's called 1985. It's out right now. Thanks earlier to Michael Monroe, of course, for joining us on the podcast. And thank you for listening each and every week. Don't forget, new episodes hit every Thursday. Be sure to subscribe so you don't miss one. And be sure to listen to me every day on the radio, SiriusXM, Faction Talk 103, live 3 to 5 Eastern daily. Replays most nights at midnight or 9 p.m. Pacific on 103. But you don't have to wait for the replays. Catch up on anything you may have missed. Interviews, audio, video, full shows, all on the SiriusXM app. Just put Trunk Nation in search. I'll see you guys next Thursday for another all-new podcast and hopefully on the radio each and every day. Take care.
Want to make Mom's Day? Get to your Nordstrom Rack now and score amazing deals for Mother's Day, which is Sunday, May 12th. Find tons of gifts from only $30 at Nordstrom Rack. Fragrance, jewelry, luxury bags, activewear, beauty, and more. Save on Kate Spade New York, Stuart Weitzman, and Ted Baker London. Great brands, great prices. So shop your Nordstrom Rack store today and treat Mom to the good stuff from just $30.
Life is a highway. And on it, there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.